Blog Talk Radio.
Because we are welcoming author and playwright Greg Oppenheimer. His dad is Jess Oppenheimer, who was one of the creator, producer, and head writer for I Love Lucy, which is one of my favorite shows that I watch every single day. So I am so excited to welcome Greg to the program. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hi. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Doing good. Looking forward to a week or so from now.
Yeah, your play is going to be hitting the stage. How cool is that?
Very exciting. This is my first play.
Your first play. Yeah, I mean, theater is such a cool thing anyway, live theater. I've been reading your dad's book, and one of the things I could really relate to is his live theater stories. You never know what's going to happen when you're on stage and it's live.
My dad's memoir, Laughs, Luck, and Lucy. Some of my favorite things in there are the stage stories. I ask you a question. Have you laughed out loud while reading?
Oh, yeah, several times. My favorite part is the handcuffs, where the handcuffs locked to his pants, to the bad guy, and he had to do the love scene. Oh.
That was the inspiration for the there was an I Love Lucy, I think it was called Lucy and the Dummy, when they're in Hollywood, and Lucy wants to do a benefit at the studio, and Ricky wants to go fishing. And so he goes fishing, but there's a dummy that they created of Desi, the studio did for his Don Juan picture, for makeup or clothes or whatever. And so she takes the dummy and pretends that's him. And she starts to dance with him, and then pretends he gets sick, and then she just goes off stage and says, I'll continue the number without him. But the dummy gets stuck to her costume. And she has to do this with dragging him around. Yeah, so that was inspired by that.
That's so funny. Oh, God. I love that. I love any stories about the live radio and the live theater. I mean, and you're doing your first play, so you know it's you never know what's going to happen.
Right. Well, I've directed a lot of things, but this is the first one that I wrote.
That's so cool. That is so cool. You got to meet Lucy and Desi and Vivian and Fred. What were they like? I mean, I know you were little, but what were they like when you first met them?
I don't remember meeting Bill Frawley, but Vivian was very nice to me, and Lucy, and they couldn't have been nicer, but I was a little kid. What are they going to do? And I went to a party at Lucy and Desi's home in Beverly Hills, which I remember. It was a great party. It was an Easter party, and they had a Ferris wheel, which is not that common in 1956. They had a clown. They had a merry-go-round, and it made a big impression on me. I was talking to Keith Thibodeau, who played Little Ricky, who was also at the party. He is my age. He and Lucy Arnaz and I are all the same age, and I talked to him after many years, but not 10 years ago. And I said, do you remember that party at the Easter party in 1956 at the house? And he says, wow, that was a great party. Remember Buffo the Clown? I said, yeah, we both had vivid memories of this party.
That's so cool. So you met Desi, too, because you didn't mention. Was he nice?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I didn't spend as much time with him, but I think I remember seeing him at their home. But I had pictures taken with Lucy and with Ethel.
How cool. That is so cool. That is really cool.
On the Staten Island Ferry set.
Oh, I love that episode where she gets seasick and they both are knocked out on pills. Oh, that's so funny. Do you have a favorite I Love Lucy episode?
The Brown Derby episode. It's called LA at Last. That's my favorite. Where William Holden, they ran into William Holden at the Brown Derby. I just love that scene.
When he gets all the food on him, poor man.
Yeah. Well, the part before that, when she's trying to eat nonchalantly while the star is staring at her, and particularly when Vivian Vance pulls the scissors out of her purse to cut the spaghetti. That's my mother, because she always carried scissors, you know, a sewing kit in her purse.
I love Bill Holden's expression. He has the
sweetest
expression on his face as he's staring at them. It's like a little boy.
And my favorite moment, I think, in all of I Love Lucy, is the end scene where they're in the hotel room, and William Holden is talking to Ricky, and Lucy is sort of fixing her nose, which, you know, she pushed to one side because it was so soft, the putty. And then he's not looking at her, and she makes her nose into this real pointed thing by, you know, not realizing what she's doing. And he's talking to Ricky, and he turns back to her, and he asks her a question. And it's just, and she looks at him, and it's a huge laugh from the audience. But Holden says his line, and you can't hear it at all. And so Lucy says, "What was that?" Because clearly nobody heard the line. And I'm thinking, you know, it's a live theater moment. You know, she's almost breaking the fourth wall there, because, you know, there's no sound going on in the hotel room. Nobody's laughing at anything, but you couldn't hear because of the audience. And it's just totally accepted because you're in the theater. One of the things that's special about I Love Lucy is there were never any retakes. There was no retake rule. So every time the audience was seeing something, they were seeing it for the first and only time. And that makes a huge difference.
Yeah. It's so fresh. That's why I think it's lasted and still funny, is because it's so fresh every episode.
Yeah. I don't know why.
Yeah.
Somebody doesn't try that now. I guess maybe they're afraid to. But the last sitcom I went to see the taping of, they did every bit of every scene three times. And then they tell the audience, please laugh in the same places. And so they try different variations, you know, on jokes and stuff. And you can tell at home it's not quite the same, not quite as real and fresh. But... And it takes 8 hours.
Yeah.
It took 42 minutes to shoot an I Love Lucy episode.
It's funny because I was an actress in the 80s, and I did The Golden Girls, and I did an episode. And the shooting day, after the audience left, we still did pickups. I didn't get home until about 1:30 a.m. because we were still doing pickups that late.
They did do pickups on I Love Lucy. Yeah, because sometimes there would be a there was a technical glitch or something. Particularly the one I remember is the freezer. Lucy gets stuck in the freezer in the basement, if you recall that one, and she ends up with icicles and everything on her face. So what they did was the plan was that they were going to shoot that without the icicles. Because it works, she just has to act cold, and they slapped a little bit of makeup, you know, on her face to make it white, you know, whiter. But that makeup took an hour to put on her, so they couldn't have the audience wait. So they finished the show without the icicle makeup, and then they said, okay, we're going to do that last scene again, but we have some special makeup to put on Lucy. You're free to go. If anybody wants to stay, they can, but you know, you're free to go. And then an hour later, they did that scene. Not one person left. Everybody just sat there for an hour. I think they had the orchestra play and entertain them a little bit. But that's, you know, very devoted audience.
Yeah, I'm like, wonder what special makeup is, you know. The curiosity factor.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you some questions about your dad. he led a very interesting life before he came to I Love Lucy. I mean, he worked for some of the greatest people ever, like Jack Benny and Fanny Bryce. And did he tell
Fred
you
Astaire,
stories about
yeah.
that? Fred Astaire. Did he tell you stories about that growing up?
Sure. That's why I put in the book. I said the book is called Laughs, Luck, and Lucy, How I Came to Create the Most Popular Sitcom of All Time. And it happens to be this month's free reading for Amazon Prime members, by the way. He had a long career in radio starting in 1936 working with all the greats, everybody from Fred Astaire to Al Jolson to Marlene Dietrich, you name it. And I just was fascinated by those things. I found, when I was 11, I found a transcription disc of the first Screen Guild show that he did in 1939 with Jack Benny and Judy Garland and Joan Crawford, and George Murphy was the host. And I just thought, this is fantastic. And so that's what got me into old radio. I just thought, this is terrific. And it was such a wild time. It was so disorganized and freewheeling and crazy. Anybody could do anything. I mean, they look at how I Love Lucy started. There were people from the movie business. The film editor was from the movie business. Carl Freund, who was the cinematographer, the director of photography for the show, had to invent how they were going to light and shoot with three cameras in front of a live audience, because I Love Lucy was the first show to do that. And while they're inventing this stuff and figure out where do we put the booth? Oh, should we have chairs or bleachers, or should we shoot in the theater? What are we going to do? They were also figuring out everything else. And they had to write the shows. They had to figure out how to edit. Once they had three cameras, how do you edit from three cameras? It's an awful lot of things. So they fortunately, somebody had a three-headed Moviola machine, which came in very handy. And actually, the guy who had built this three-headed Moviola machine, a guy named George Fox, and the plan was to have, originally there were going to be four cameras, because they didn't, Desi was convinced that the audience wouldn't sit still for long delays, and he thought of it as a night at the theater, which it sort of was. So they were going to have continuous with no breaks. No costume changes, except you take off something and, that's your costume, because there's no time for it. And they would have three cameras, and then when they needed to reload, they would have a fourth camera cover the action just long enough for the other cameras to reload. That didn't work at all. So that lasted one show. And George Fox had this Moviola machine with three heads that he built for some Truth or Consequences or some other show. And it was across the street at Consolidated Film Industries, the film labs, across the street from the studio. But somebody had a key. I think that Danny Kahn, who was the film editor, had the key to George Fox's space at CFI. And after trying to edit all this footage from all the four cameras on the first show, and they were getting nowhere because there was just too much to keep track of, they said, let's go use his machine. So in the middle of the night, they went over there, busted it. Well, they had the key, but they went in without permission and used his machine. And he got he started almost sued. My dad settled the lawsuit and bought the machine from him. And then that's how they ended up with what they called the three-headed monster, which made editing fairly simple, because you run all three cameras, the picture, into this Moviola machine with the soundtrack. And you can see it all at once, and just mark which one you want, which camera you want to use as you go along. Anyway, that's not
so
about old radio, but
But there's so much from I Love Lucy and the creation of Desi Lou's technique and stuff that we still use today that people don't realize that every comedy show you see, I mean, pretty much every show you see that has an audience is thanks to I Love Lucy and what Desi and your dad,
right.
and
even
and
when you go
Carl
into see,
and,
you, when you go in to see a sitcom and you walk in and there's the bleachers and there's the booth at the top of the bleachers. That's just because they said, well, where are we going to put the booth? Why don't we put it at the top of the bleach? Okay. Well, the bleachers. Let's put it up there. And the arrangement was just what they decided. Let's do it this way. And they've been doing it ever since 1951, exactly the same way Isle of Lucy did it. Just because that's what they did. I mean, you know, like at CBS in 1951, when they shot the pilot, the booth wasn't in the back of the audience. It was on the attached to the wall on the left side. And when they did the radio shows, the booth was on the stage, you know, at one end of the stage, you know, where the actors were. So I mean, it didn't have to be this way, and they could have changed it, but nobody, you know, people don't like changing things.
No. If it's not broke, don't fix it.
Right. And I always get upset when I people talk about the laugh track on Isle of Lucy. And I said, there was no laugh track.
There was
not. Every laugh you hear is somebody actually from the Isle of Lucy audience. And they had a laugh library. Of laughs that they recorded from the shows. They would use, like, if they had to edit something out, and they had to cover the edit with a laugh. But that's not having a laugh track. That's just using it to bridge something.
But you can actually hear Desi laughing off stage. And
oh,
you can
sure.
also hear, I mean, not just, I mean, famously you can hear Lucy's mom, Dee Dee, but you also can hear Desi a lot of times laughing his head off, because his laugh is very distinctive.
Right. And sometimes you can hear the audience, like Lucy's dangling out of the Cornell Wilde's hotel room upstairs, she throws down her shoe to get Ethel's attention in the room below, and then when she comes down, she's only got one shoe on, and you can hear a woman in the audience say to the other woman, "She threw the other one down before."
I never heard that. I'll have to rewatch that episode.
Yeah. I think on the DVD, I think I put that in as one of the bonus things where I highlight that. I'm not sure. But if you listen closely, you can.
Oh, that is so funny. Actually, I saw, I was looking at YouTube in preparation for our interview, and one of the interviews with Desi, he was talking with David Letterman about how he can still hear the laughs from I Love Lucy on shows today, then, which was in 83 when he did that interview.
Yeah, there was a guy named Charlie Douglas who invented the laugh track machine, and he stole the he was working with CBS, so CBS gave him the laugh library from I Love Lucy, and that's what they used to load into the machine. And, I mean, my dad did work on shows later that had laugh tracks, and I spent many an hour with Dad and Charlie Douglas in the control booth putting the laughs on a show. And you know, we recognized some of those laughs, too. But the uh-oh woman, the lady who says, uh-oh.
Uh-huh. Wait. Uh-oh.
Yeah. Uh-oh.
Was that Dee Dee?
I don't think so.
Who did the uh-oh? Oh.
I don't think it was.
I know I could recognize her laugh, but I always try to figure out who people are that you hear all the time, and it sort of sounds like the same timbre, so that's why I was just curious.
Yeah. Dee Dee was, she would sit in the top row just under the booth with Bob and Madeline, the other two writers besides my dad. Dee Dee and when Desi's mother was there, she'd sit there too. But because, you know, I'd sit in the back, too, when I was there. I didn't sit in the front row because you get the best view from up there. Front row seats isn't always the best. Because you can see over, because the cameras are not in the way, yeah.
And that's still today. That's still, I mean, my mom wasn't very well, and we went to see Hot in Cleveland. So they gave us access, and they sat us in the front. And it's the first time I ever sat up there, so I didn't really know. And I noticed that, you know, some of the, like, they had stuff to the side. There was like a courtroom scene, and
yeah.
the cameras were in front. And she said, "This kind of does remind me of the old days." And I said, "Well, it's because this is where we are, Mom. Can't we're up in the back. We would see it." And I go, "But you can't walk." My mom couldn't walk up the stairs. That's why they put her over there.
The difference now is back then it was all about the audience. And it was so much about the audience. When they shot the first show, not the pilot, but the first episode, Danny Kahn went looking for my dad during the filming, and he couldn't find him. So he finally found him pacing up and down behind the bleachers. Dad was just listening to the audience reaction, because that's what he was used to in radio. He was judging how things were going by hearing how the audience was reacting. But now they treat them like it's a privilege for the audience to be there and to see them doing their work, but we're really doing this for the TV viewing audience, and aren't you lucky to be here? And so they'll shoot something way off to the side, and you just have to watch it on monitors, because sorry, we can't let you see this live because it's inconvenient, But watch your TV set. But back then, everything. They wouldn't think of doing that. Everything was for the audience that was there.
Yep. Yeah. My mom and dad used to see a lot of the live. In fact, they went to see I Love Lucy. They saw Groucho. They saw Armis Brooks. They saw my dad worked nights, so he in the daytime, and they didn't have a lot of money, and in the daytime they went to see the shows. So I grew up hearing about all this stuff. I wasn't alive, but I heard about all
these
shows.
But they filmed. Well, I Lucy. They filmed at night.
No, I mean, Daddy didn't start until like 11 o'clock.
Ah, okay. Yeah.
So
be
he
over
did.
By that.
That's what I meant. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's why he thought they went to all the shows. They went to. Everything. And
you used to be able to walk up and down Hollywood Boulevard, and there would be kiosks where you could get tickets to all the different shows.
Yeah. It was like really cool. It was much nicer, and they said it was much more comfortable back then. I don't really understand what they mean, but that's what they said. I go, "How is it comfortable? It's still the bleacher seat things." And they said,
"But you're only sitting in it for 45 minutes."
You mean back then?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. That makes sense. Okay. Yeah. I was just, why is that more comfortable? And they never really could explain it to me, so I was just curious. There was another thing I wanted to ask you about. In the book, you were talking, your dad was talking about asking people to be in a TV series about the Ten Commandments. No, to write a TV series about the Ten Commandments. And he actually got letters from amazing people. Do you want to tell a little bit about that?
I don't have that in front of me, so you have to quote it, not me. But he had a series that he had an idea for a series called The Ten Commandments, where each episode would be the theme of it would be one of the commandments, like thou shalt not kill, whatever. And I think they only did the pilot for it was they did I can't remember what it was, but I remember it started Arthur Kennedy. But he said when they interviewed him about it, they're going to do one on each commandment. He says, if we get picked up for a 13-week deal, we'll have to make up some commandment. But the idea was to have a literary great write each one. The pilot one was Third Commandment, and it was written by Ben Hecht, who and Charles MacArthur wrote the front page. But that he wrote to a lot of people, such as John Steinbeck and James Thurber and Edna Ferber, and he got these incredible letters back, very funny letters that I put in the book. The one from John Steinbeck. He wrote to him and said, I was hoping I could goose you into working on my this project. And Steinbeck wrote back a very nice letter saying, just started another novel and there's no way I can do it, but thanks very much. I enjoyed being goosed.
I thought that was so cute. I just loved it.
James Thurber wrote back, said, I'm afraid my sales doesn't allow me to do this, but to work on this Ten Commandments, it seems a noble project. I don't cover my neighbor's wife, but I do steal. Best of luck to you and you and Moses and the others.
Oh, amazing. Edna Ferber.
That was a whole, yeah. Edna Ferber.
Yeah, that was a whole mishigas.
He got a letter back from Edna Ferber she used some language that was surprising about jazzing up the Ten Commandments or something, and he wrote back a letter saying, I didn't know about having you do one before, but now you have to do one. Now that you referred to it as jazzing up, and she wrote back saying, or her secretary wrote back, said, you must be mistaken, Miss Ferber never said jazzing up the Ten Commandments, and so he sent her a copy of the letter, and so he had this whole back and forth with her about the who wrote the letter, whether she'd written this letter that she had written, and it was very funny. But if people want to see that, they should just get the book. It's in the Kindle edition as well.
Yeah, just the sign. I hope you guys have that framed, those letters framed somewhere from those amazing people.
I think I've got my dad's old typewriter and with a copy of the Thurber letter in the roll. So if you go to look at the typewriter, you see the letter.
Because, oh, my God, just the signatures are just like, I saw that, and I was, looking at it. I was like, oh, my God, look at that. They actually signed it. How cool is that?
Yeah.
I'm going to change directions. I wanted to ask, how did the play come about, and what was the creative process, and how did it come about? How did you start off on it?
It was more of a bank shot. I wrote the book and I was going to try and get another book deal on something, and was not able to do that. So I decided, why don't I make a movie out of this book? Right, I'll write a script, which is what everybody does, right?
Right.
And I'd written some scenes, and I wasn't really getting very far with it. And then I was invited to, there's a thing called Lucy Desi Comedy Festival in Jamestown, where she's from. And for her 100th birthday, they invited me to come back. And I have been directing recreations of My Favorite Husband, her radio show, in a number of places. And they invited me to come and do that. And I said, I had an idea. I said, I have a play about how Lucy was created. Can I do that too? And they said, sure. So I didn't really have a play. I had some scenes for a movie. So I took my scenes and I, worked furiously on it. Now that I had a deadline, the reason I said that is I knew it would force me to actually get something written. And it's also motivation if you know you can get an audience to see it, as opposed to if I'd written a movie script and would wait 20 years for someone to buy it. So I wrote a thing called I Love Lucy, The Untold Story, which is how they got the show on the air. And we did it at the theater in Jamestown where Lucy went to see monologists. That's right. Who was the humorist of the day in vaudeville, and that's where she learned to love comedy when she was a teenager, and it was very well received, and then I started doing readings around town, they were well received too, and so I expanded it, and it just sort of kept growing and growing, and finally I ended up with a full play. And LA Theater Works, who I'd submitted to in several versions, finally said, "Yeah, we love it. Let's do it." So, and we were off to the races.
And the play is called I Love Lucy, A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Sitcom.
Right.
It's an adorable title. How did you come to that title from what you had before?
Well, it was called I Love Lucy, The Untold Story, because I thought it was, you know, there's a TV movie every 10 years or so about Lucy and Desi. And they never talk about what I think are the funniest and most fascinating stories, which is behind the scenes of how the show got on the air. They say something about it, but it's never accurate, and they never really get into it. And so I figured this is the untold story that I wanted to be told. And I finally changed that because some people thought that this was like a script, a Lucy script that I found, the lost script, the untold story. So I said, okay, I need to change it to something so people know this is about getting to I Love Lucy and also that it's a comedy. and so I came up with that title about a year ago or 2 years ago and changed it. And that's how we got the title.
It's adorable. And so it's going to be at UCLA for 5 performances, is that correct? And
right.
Then it's going to be later on, it's going to be on radio, so everybody can hear it.
July 12th through 15th at UCLA's James Bridges Theater. All the details are at latw.org. That's for LA Theater Works. latw.org has all the details. And it's Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. We've got Sarah Drew, star of Grey's Anatomy. She plays April in Grey's Anatomy. Oscar Nunez from The Office, he was Oscar the Accountant, is playing Desi. Sarah Drew is playing Lucy. Seamus Dever, who is Detective Kevin Ryan on Castle, one of the 4 stars of that show. And he's playing my dad. The entire cast is great, but those are the main 3 characters. It's going to be tremendous. It's a radio theater performance, so they stand in front of microphones with scripts, just like old-time radio. And
cool.
You get to see the Foley artist making the sound effects live on stage, which is a lot of fun. And if you come to the theater, the settings will be projected on the screen behind the actors. So there aren't, you know, built sets, but we project the sets onto the screen behind them. And I'm a sort of obsessive in terms of accuracy. So these are what you'll see is the actual, like the actual Arnaz living room, and the actual office at CBS and everything. So,
how cool!
Even the actual La Jolla Playhouse, found Vivian Vance.
Vivian, yeah.
Yeah.
That is really cool. I have a question I have to ask. I was reading, and it said that your dad actually used that contraption that they put on Ricky's head when Ricky thought he was losing his hair.
Oh, sure.
Oh my God.
Ricky thinks he's getting bald.
It looks like a torture chamber thing.
Right, and he put in one of the things, my Bob and Madeline would sit in the office with my dad on all day Monday after the read-through in the morning, and they'd have to come up with, okay, what are we going to do a show about? And so they would end up, by the end of the day, you know, there were no interruptions allowed. By the end of the day, they had a pretty well plotted out a show. They had to. And, you know, the pace, there were 40 shows in 40 weeks in the first 40 weeks of the show. And then they typed it up, an outline with all the story points. And then Bob and Madeline would go write a first draft script, and I would come back to Dad, and he would mark it up, and it would go back to them. They would come up with a second draft, and that would come back to him, and then it would never go back to them. He would take that, make the changes, he marked the changes he wanted, and then he would dictate the whole thing from start to finish into a dictation machine. And then it would go to Mimeo, and that was what the actors saw on, you know, Monday morning. And he just thought it was important for it all to be filtered through one person's senses, so it would be consistent from, you know, week to week in terms of what the different characters were doing. So because he was dictating it from start to finish, if some funny thought occurred to him, he would just include it as a stage direction or an aside or something. And so the scripts have these great little asides. And so when it gets to that contraption, I think it's called the scalp agitator, Ricky's using. And it says in the script, it's parenthetical, it says, see the producer, he endured this particular machine at the start of what has become, what turned out to be a very becoming lack of hair. Because my dad was bald.
Oh, my God. It's like there's this line that Ricky says. He says, my eyebrows aren't going bald, because it was right on his eyebrow.
That show was that show was supposed to end with the bald man's party, where they invited all the bald people over to make Ricky realize he wasn't really losing his hair, and all the clients of the place where they sold those contraptions, that sold the cures, and the machine was so much funnier, that scene, that they rearranged the episode and made that the finale.
Yeah, his tagline is the best. He says, oh,
yeah.
No, this is really good. We're going to do it every day.
It didn't work on my dad.
No, there is no cure, as far as I know, except what they do now with the plugs and stuff.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I've always loved that. That's one of my favorites. I don't know why. I guess because he has so much hair that it's just
for
so
him to
funny
think he's losing it. Yeah.
Yeah. He's one of those lucky men who had lots of hair and just little tiny little bit of a space in the back of his head. It's like. It's like, why do men do that? So it was a brilliant idea.
Well, it works
idea.
Because it's all about perception. It's if you think you need it, you need it.
But the other thing I loved about that particular episode was it all started because Lucy saw crow's feet. But
yeah.
It was like once he said he thought she was beautiful and it wasn't a big deal, she was over it. But he became obsessed.
Right.
And I thought,
yeah.
That's really funny. It was on a couple of days ago, and I recorded it so I could remind myself before we talked, because I always love that episode. We don't have that much time, but I wanted you to tell us about, like, where it's at UCLA, but it's at a specific area of UCLA. And also, do you want me to give the phone number, or do you want to give the phone number?
For the box office?
For the play, yeah.
Oh, you can give it.
Okay.
Although it's the easiest, if you haven't, the web.
I have it right in front of
me. Listeners do.
Okay. It's called Theater Work, LA Theater Works, and the phone number is 310-827-0889, or as Greg said, the website is www.latw.org, and it's
right.
At UCLA, which is one of my favorite places in the whole wide world, and it's not just because I went there, but it's because it's one of the prettiest campuses. I went to Cal State Northridge and UCLA, and my brother would kill me because he's a USC guy, but I think it's the prettiest campus in Los Angeles.
The theater is very easy to find. If you go to the latw.org, they will show you how to get there. And if you buy tickets, you get a thing, an email explaining exactly where it is. Because there's a part, one of the UCLA parking lots is right there, like, you know, steps away from the theater. So it's very convenient. You're going to have to walk across
the street.
James Bridges Theater.
James Bridges Theater. And
it's Thursday
July
and Friday at 8 p.m.
Friday
at 8 and Saturday at 3 and 8 and Sunday at 4. And mostly we have tickets at this point for Thursday and Friday. But there's a few tickets left for Saturday and Sunday.
How cool. And will you be there the whole time? Will you be? Will people be able to meet you?
I will be there for all five performances. I wouldn't miss it for the world.
Yeah, plays are very short nowadays. You know, it's not like 6 months; it's only 5 days, so it's a little easier to arrange your schedule.
Right. And it's not a long play; it was one act and with no intermission. So.
So, did I miss anything that you wanted me to say?
I think we mentioned that the book, if they look up my name or Laughs, Luck, and Lucy on Amazon, if you're an Amazon Prime member, it's free this month. And even if you're not, it's only $2.99, and all the royalties go to the Pediatric AIDS Foundation. So even if you missed
it. I paid for it.
Deadline.
Good paid for it. Kindle.
Oh, so
it's
you have the previous version of the play at the back of the book then.
Uh huh. Yeah, I haven't gotten to that yet.
Yeah.
I'm trying to go in order. So I'm only what chapter am I on now? I'm on chapter 9.
What's it called?
So
the
my
favorite
comedian.
Oh, The Eyes Have It. Yeah. My dad discovers he sees double.
Yeah. Well, no, this is where. This is when he finally discovers it. I just got to that page.
One of the other things my dad also invented the teleprompter.
I didn't know that.
And Lucy and Desi were the first people to use a teleprompter on TV. Yeah, he was sitting at home with my mother and watching television and watching a news person reading, you know, the news and not looking at the camera, an ambulance or somebody fire engine or something went by outside, and he looked at the window where the den that they were watching TV in, and all he could see was a reflection of himself, realized that if someone was outside looking in, they wouldn't see the reflection. They would see clearly, you know, the interior. And so he had the idea of using a piece of glass and a reflection off of it. Someone could look right into the camera and read their lines from a reflection of a script. But the camera, which is on the dark side of it, would just see the actor. And so you could look right into the camera and read your lines. And that's where the idea came from.
Fascinating.
And Lucy and
really
Desi were the first people to use it. They used it not on. They never used it on the show. They used it for a Philip Morris cigarette commercial. And he didn't. Somebody read somewhere he read it because they needed it or they wanted it or something. That's not true at all. He used it on I, Lucy and had them do it because he wanted to try it out, and it saved them having to learn the commercials. But he would never use it on the dramatic parts of the show.
That's interesting. That's really fascinating. Yeah, because Desi had a photographic memory. He didn't need it. But yeah, that's really cool. Because, I mean, all the innovation that your dad and Desi and all the people who created that show, that is like people don't even think about it today. That they
like
created.
The rerun.
It's just, yeah. The rerun. And
it changed the whole.
It
moved the whole TV industry from New York to Hollywood.
And the
and
clip
changed,
show.
Changed the economic model.
And the clip show. Well, that's what I call it.
Yeah.
It's when flashback. Yeah. Basically, to me, it's like, okay, we ran out of budget, and we got to come up with a nice storyline where we can put something, and we'll put a whole bunch of stuff in it, and.
Right. Well, they didn't
really.
They only did
show.
One clip. They did one clip show years later, but the first ones were not clip shows. They were like a flashback show because they didn't think they could just put a rerun on. And also, they were putting a rerun, if they couldn't put a rerun on in the middle of the season when she was pregnant, and all of a sudden she wasn't pregnant, and it wouldn't make any sense. So they said, "Oh, remember when this happened to Lucy?" And they're sitting there, and she's pregnant, or she's not there, because she's in the hospital, or home, and then they show the rerun, and they very cleverly did the same thing with the shows that weren't reruns. So if you look in the second season, there's a whole bunch of shows where they just say, "Remember when Lucy did this?" And then they'll sort of flash back, but it's not an episode you've seen before. It's just that's the way they started, with sort of a remembering thing. And so people got used to seeing the shows start with that, and so they didn't say, "Oh, this is going to be another rerun. let's tune off." They just they stayed watching.
It's smart. It was smart. It was very, very smart. They still do it today.
It didn't turn out to be necessary because when they ran the reruns, the ratings actually went up, just because there were so many more people who'd bought TVs that they weren't reruns to them.
And it's also kind of interesting because he and your dad came up with that idea because basically they wanted to let Lucy bond with her baby and be with their older daughter too. So they needed.
They didn't want to live in New York.
Yeah. But I'm just
talking about. She wanted to be in California.
When Desi was born, when Desi Jr. was born, the flashback and all that stuff was basically.
That's because the doctor said she has to be off from November to March.
Exactly
where it came from. Yeah.
And
because
I think
she'd
that's
had
sort of sweet.
Yeah,
because she has a cesarean.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
For both, yeah.
Yeah.
For kids.
Yeah, but I just think it's kind of sweet if you think about it.
Well, yeah, it was. People kept watching, and that was the biggest thing. They thought they were. The strangest thing is at the end of the episode where Lucy has the baby, the sponsor comes on and congratulates Lucy and Ricky. And Lucy or Desi had the baby that day, and they knew that was the case. But for some reason, Philip Morris is congratulating Lucy and Ricky.
How weird is that?
But a lot of people got mixed up. They just thought, and all his life, Desi Jr. said, "Oh, I loved you on the show," and he said, "I was never on the show."
That must have been so hard on Desi Jr. I mean, really. He's like, I'm not that guy. That's a different person. That's Keith. And
he actually was.
Baby.
He was actually on the very last episode. He's standing there, and Vivian Vance is holding his hand. He's just a kid there.
That's the statue.
Yeah.
I remember. I didn't know which child it was, but now I do. So it's the one that Vivian stands next to at the end of that episode. Okay. I always knew he was in that, but I didn't know which child he was.
But the little girl is not Lucy.
Yeah, Lucy Arnaz said that in an interview. I didn't know that. I always thought the older girl was Lucy, but apparently it wasn't.
Yeah. She knows who it was. It was some friend, but it wasn't her.
Oh, it was a friend of Lucy's?
I didn't know that.
Oh, that's cool. We've come to the end. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to come on the show. Everybody who is in Los Angeles or is coming to Los Angeles in July, go to the website and buy tickets for the show. You said which days were still open?
There's some tickets for all the days, but the most tickets are available for Thursday and Friday.
So
but
buy up
go,
Thursday
go to the,
and Friday too.
Sure.
But buy all the days, whatever day you can. Fill them up, sell them out.
It'll be a lot of fun. It'll be a lot of laughs. I guarantee you, it'll be very funny. It'll feel almost like a Lucy episode.
Oh, gosh, that's so fantastic. And like I said, thank you so much for coming on the show. I really enjoy chatting with you.
Me too.
Thank you. And thank you for chatting with Sherry.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.